If you're going to stand for God, it'll cost you something. Now, I know that most of us today know very little about suffering. Now, Paul says that if you're going to live godly in Christ Jesus, you're going to suffer persecution. Now, Peter, writing his first epistle in the 4th chapter, 12th and 13th verses, says, "Beloved, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you. But rejoice, inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy." Now, he's saying here the same thing, you see. And not to think it strange concerning the fiery trial that's going to try you. And as if there's no way out of it, but to have that fiery trial. And not to think that it's some strange thing that's happened to you, that it happens to all of God's children. I remember when I was pastor in Cleburne, Texas. It's not a very big place, friends. It's just about 15,000 people, and that's all you have. It's not a very big place, but I remember that there were two suicides in the town. They were in a town that size. They're generally pretty well hushed up. But I was called, and fortunately, neither family was a member of my church directly. One family had relatives in my church. And I was called and told about these. One of them were not church people at all. They were not Christians. So I went by to see them and attempted to comfort them the best I could. Then I went by to see the other family, and the interesting thing, the first thing that they said when I went in the door, they said to me, "Dr. McGee, why is it that this should happen to us? Nobody has ever been called upon to go through what we've been called upon to go through." Well, may I say, I'd just come from another family in a town of 15,000 on the same day that it had the same experience. And so, you see, they thought they were the only ones. And they say, of course, there is the saying, misery loves company. And I think it really was quite a revelation to them to find out that there was another family in the same town that was in the same kind of sorrow that they were in. I'm of the opinion it brought something of comfort to them. And the Word of God says, "Think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened unto you, but rejoice, inasmuch as ye are partakers of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory shall be revealed, ye may be glad also with exceeding joy." I reckon, or I calculate, or I have put this down on the debit and credit side and figured it out mathematically, that the sufferings of this present world, of this present time, are not worthy to be compared, Listen to Paul again in 2 Corinthians 4:17. "For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, worketh for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory, that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory about to be revealed upon and in us." About us today is this tremendous universe, and it's waiting for something that's going to take place, for something is going to take place in it. And we are finding that in this present age in which we live, that these sufferings that we're undergoing here, friends, they're not worthy to be compared. They're not worthy to be compared with the glory, the glory, if you please, which is to be revealed in us. That is today the high anticipation of every child of God, to know that the sufferings that you're going through today, they're not strange, friends. Not some strange thing has happened to you that nobody else has ever had. All of God's children are called upon to go through these sufferings, and they serve a purpose. They accomplish a goal. I'm of the opinion that there are going to be many people in heaven that are going to look back down upon this earthly scene, and you will look back upon today, and you will say, I have a notion that many of us are going to say, oh, if I could go back down and live my life over again, I tell you, I wouldn't complain like I did. I wouldn't find fault like I did. And I'd take a stand. I'd be willing to pay the price. And that little suffering down there that I used to whine about and complain about and think it was such an awful, terrible thing, how small it seems now with this eternal weight of glory that I've received. Why, I wish I could go back down there and live it over. I'd certainly take a stand for God. So that, you see, gives a wonderful significance to today for you and me, friends, this day in which we're living. Now, I believe today that we're called upon to undergo a great deal of trial and a great deal of suffering. A preacher friend of mine, I have a letter from him. He's way over yonder on the East Coast. And he's had to take time out. And he's been in a rough spot. He had a tough situation in a church, but he stayed there and he bore it, and he's still there. But he's had to take time out, and he wrote me. I'll tell you where he was. He was in Florida. He said, I've had to come down here. And he said, you have no notion what I've gone through. But he says, I thank God that He enabled me to go through with it. And he says, I think we've won our battle, and I'm going back soon as I get to feeling a little bit better. Well, thank God for men like that today, that are standing for the things of God today and are willing to pay a price. I wish that we had more people in our churches today that were willing to endure hardship and willing to be criticized, willing to take a stand for Jesus Christ. My, I tell you, friends, when we get over yonder and look back down here, this thing that may look like a mountain to you today is going to be a molehill when you get over there. And you're going to say, well, I thought that was awful that I was called upon to go through. And you're going to find out it wasn't awful at all. It didn't really amount to too much. And you'll just only regret that you didn't endure more for it. I tell you, as we look yonder at the goal that's ahead of us and what's coming up, it all enable us to bear with patience down here, whatever you call, to go through today. Now, I know I'm talking to many people that are upon a bed of pain and sickness, and they're wondering why they're there. And there are many people today facing problems, and they're in a dark place, and they're wondering why. Well, listen, believe God, will you? Just believe God has a purpose in it, and let Him know you're willing to go along. None of us welcome it. We'd be abnormal if we did. But the point is, when it comes to us, to be able to say to Him, O Lord, may Thy grace be sufficient, and point me to that day that's coming someday. Now, the verse 19 reads, for the earnest expectation of the creature waiteth for the manifestation of the sons of God. Now, let me give you this translation, which is ours. For the creation watching with outstretched head is waiting, even sighing, for the revelation of the sons of God. Now, that is a glorious picture that's given to us here. You know, the world is not waiting for the sunrise of evolution's pipe dream, but it is waiting for the apocalypse, the revelation of the sons of God. Creation today is like an unveiled statue. And when the sons of God have removed the outward covering of this flesh and their new bodies are given to them, then creation also will be unveiled. That's a glorious day that's yet in the future. May I say to you today, what a foolish picture that evolution gives us. They go way back in the millions and millions of the years of the past. And then they talk about the millions of the years in the future, and we're going to get a little improvement in a million years, according to them. Thank God that's not true. That's not the picture that's presented in the Word of God. But creation today is watching, and the picture is with a head erect, outstretched head, a head erect, and it's waiting and even sighing for the revelation of the sons of God. My friend, what a picture that is for us here. It's a picture, as you look about us today, we see a creation that's in travail and pain, as we are going to see when we get to the next verse. And all of that is going to be lifted and removed. And creation today is in the position of wanting, longing, waiting for that day when there will be a glorious, wonderful deliverance. And it's a position of expectation today, of looking in anticipation to a day when there will be a glorious deliverance wrought. Now, I think I probably better bring up the next verse 20, because it seems to me that it's connected with verse 19 very closely. For the creature was made subject to vanity, not willingly, but by reason of him who hath subjected the same in hope. Now, let me give you again our translation. For the creation was subjected to vanity, that is, failure, that is decay, that which is perishable, not of its own will, but by reason, or because of him who subjected it on the basis of hope, or in hope. Now, not only did the curse of sin come upon man in Adam's disobedience, but the physical world came also under the curse. I wonder if you realize, and I'm sure that none of us do, you and I, friend, today do not even have a notion of just how wonderful this world was before man's sin, and man's sin plunged it into the state of chaos that it actually is in today. Now, you will recall that when God made the heavens and the earth, we read that in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Then that, by the way, is the only verse on creation that we have. It was all the raw material was made at that time, whenever that was, and that's lots farther back than anyone's ever dreamed of. Then something happened. Evidently, there was a judgment came upon this universe. Before man got here, the earth was without form and void. God just hasn't seen fit to give us very much about that, and I think the reason is that that's his business, and it concerns another creation before we got here, before our race was here, and it has to do with another order of things and beings, and a judgment came upon it. Then we find that God moved in and brought in order, and then he put man on this earth. After 6 days of renovation, after 6 days in which God refurbished, redecorated, and brought in cosmos where there had been chaos. Now, as God moved into this picture and put man here, then man was occupied a tremendous position. I think that if you and I today could have seen that world back there, that our eyes would just bug out. I just think that today we have no notion how beautiful it really was. Have you ever noticed that today man, even today, can take a little piece of desert ground and he can put some water on it and begin to set out plants, and before long it becomes really a veritable Garden of Eden. Just look what man today, even in sin, little puny man that's lost dominion, look what he can do with the desert today. How beautiful and wonderful this world must have been before man's sin. Because you see, man's sin brought this world that he was given dominion over. And as we suggested the other day, man actually ruled this world. Now, when man sinned, the earth went down. It went down under the fall. All that was implicated. It's just like when Hitler fell, all Germany went down. When Adam fell, all that belonged to him, this earth, went down in an awful, awful fall. And we read back in Genesis, the 3rd chapter, and I'll begin reading at the 17th verse. And unto Adam he said, because thou hast hearkened unto the voice of thy wife, hast eaten of the tree of which I commanded thee, saying, thou shalt not eat of it. Cursed is the ground for thy sake. In sorrow shalt thou eat of it all the days of thy life. Thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and thou shalt eat the herb of the field. In the sweat of thy face shalt thou eat bread, till thou return unto the ground, for out of it wast thou taken, for dust thou art, and unto dust shalt thou return. Now, you see, God pronounced the curse on even the very ground, and the ground underneath you, friends, has a curse resting upon it. You see, anywhere you turn today, friends, you find that going on, the curse that's resting upon nature today. Anyone that's attempted to grow anything knows that there is today a curse resting upon the earth. It's there. You and I cannot escape it. You and I cannot in any ways get away from it. There is a curse resting upon this earth. And it's there because of man's sin. And one of these days, that's going to be removed. Now, Paul says that the creation is waiting in expectation. I'd be honest with you. I think that the snails, and I think the all of this this bloody fang and sharp claw that nature exhibits today, I don't think nature would like to go on with that sort of thing. I believe, frankly, that nature would like to call the whole thing off, and that nature today would like, if you please, to see all of the curse removed, because there's a groaning going on in nature, and it was not subjected because of something it did, but it was subjected because of man's sin. because of what man did down here. And it was Adam's disobedience that brought this upon the earth. Now, friends, you find that everywhere upon the earth, that this earth has suffered a great catastrophe in the past. And not only one, but apparently several, you see. They tell you that today. The ocean bed today. I was reading an article the other night about the studies that are being made of the ocean bed, that some great convulsion took place even out there. The mountains bear testimony to that. You can never go into the mountains and take a look at them and see these great layers of rocks, just like a layer cake, one right upon another. Whereas on the other side of the canyon, why, that same layer's turned upside down and is altogether different. Some great convulsion took place, you see, in the past. It was M. Roos who made the statement years ago, "Everywhere our eyes meet images of death and decay, the scourge of barrenness, the fury of the elements, the destructive instincts of beasts, the very laws which govern vegetation, everything gives nature a sombre hue." The creation, and I believe that Paul means by the creation here, he actually means, if you please, this earth, and it confines it to this earth alone. However, I do believe that this vast universe that we live in bears evidences of a fall way back yonder in the past. But we'll not go into that at all or speak of that. When we were talking about Genesis several years ago on this program, we went into detail in that. And we recommend, if you want a book on that, Pemba's book, Earth's Earliest Ages, even in spite of all the new discoveries that have been made, new findings, that book is still a very interesting, engaging book and thought-provoking book. Now, evidently it was the earth then that Paul is talking about here, that when he speaks of the creation, and it's not creatures in our translation, but actually it's for the creation was made subject to vanity. And that means this earth. Now, vanity is not the word which means empty here, but matios, meaning idle or resultless. You know, nature never seems to accomplish some great purpose. There's a weary round of repetition as far as nature is concerned. The writer to the Ecclesiastes, in the first chapter, the fifth verse, put it like this, "The sun also ariseth, and the sun goeth down and hasteth to his place where he arose. The wind goeth toward the south and turneth about unto the north. It whirleth about continually, and the wind returneth again according to his circuits. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing." You see, what a picture we're given here of nature, the monotony, actually, that is in nature, if you please. It, just the same old thing over and over and over again. It's made subject, you see, to apparently that which has no result in view. There is actually, and I think it's being proven today, that actually this idea of the fact that nature has some purpose in mind, that it's attempting to evolve into something bigger and better. There's nothing that is quite as silly as that. Nature has no purpose in mind whatsoever. It was made that purposeless by the sin of man. We come back today to this very engaging section that reaches out and looks into the future when you and I are going to get a redeemed, renewed, glorified body. You see, that is the goal and aim of God in this matter of our salvation. God is not just going to stop with us the way we are today. Now, aren't you glad of that? Years ago down in Mississippi, a dear little lady in a Methodist testimony meeting got up, had on a sunbonnet, and she got up and said, you know, most Christians ought to have written on their back a sign that says, this is not the best that the grace of God can do. Well, that ought to be on my back today, and I have a notion it ought to be on your back today. And by the way, I would like to add to that sign on my back and say, this is not all that the grace of God's going to do for me. I have a glorified body, and that is out yonder in the future. That is something that He is yet to give to us. Part of the wonderful things that come to us in our salvation, and they all come by grace. Now He's talking here about the fact that creation, that is, this earth at the time of man's sin, because of Adam's disobedience, that this physical earth came in under the curse. Thorns and thistles shall it bring forth to thee, and that by the sweat of the brow you'll eat of it. And if there are any of you eating without working, friends, you're really putting something over on the Lord. I'll tell you that. But I have a notion that somewhere down the line that you have done some work. And if you haven't, somebody else then had to do it for you. Because man can only get from this earth that which it'll yield by labor, by the sweat of his brow. Because nature today has been made subject to vanity. And that means that nature has no goal in mind. It was Darwin that suggested that there was such a thing as natural selection, that nature was choosing the best even. Nature had a purpose, and that is where evolution got underway, that nature seemed to have a mind of its own. Well, it doesn't, of course. It's purposeless. Since the curse has come upon it, and no purpose or goal in mind at all. And instead of it going upward and onward, why, it may develop in this field. Then in another field it may go down because it has no goal in mind whatsoever. And it's been made that way because of man's sin. But it was made that way because of man's sin, but not of its own will, God says. In other words, creation did not have a will like Adam, and creation did not deliberately choose the pathway of vanity. This came, of course, as a result of Adam's willing and Adam's doing. And then it says, though, that God did it, but because of him who subjected it on the basis of hope. Now, that's a phrase that contains rich suggestion, friends. Twice in this verse are we told that creation was subjected. Now, who's responsible for it? Well, God subjected it, but the form of construction suggests that God's will is the worker, but the result is not his work. Man's sin is responsible. And this doesn't exhaust the thought, as Godet, the French expositor, suggests. You see, Satan has taken over man's dominion. He's the one that's the roaring lion going up and down this earth. And he's the prince of the air, possessing the kingdoms of this world. And in view of all of this complication, the prospect for the future looks bleak, you say. But that's not so. God has destined a glorious hope and future for creation. My, what a glorious, wonderful things in store for this earth, you see. And now, God does have a purpose in mind. Although today, under the curse of man's sin, there's no goal or purpose at all. The writer to the Ecclesiastes says that the water runs down the rivers and into the ocean. And then what happens? Well, evaporation takes place, and the clouds move out over the land again. Then there's a storm up in the high Sierras and way over yonder in the Rockies. And then the snow stays there. The sun comes out and melts it, begins to trickle down to a mountain stream. Before long, it becomes a roaring torrent, and it then goes into the Colorado River, and the Boulder Dam up there holds it for a little while, but comes running around that, and finally goes down in the Gulf of California. And then what happens? Well, here goes evaporation again. It's taken up, moves out, and here it comes again. Mine had a weary round. And the writer to Ecclesiastes says, under the sun, everything's vanity. I mean, it seems purposeless, does it not? It seems empty. The word here, though, has to do with there's no result accomplished. A few mountains are worn down, sometimes there's a flood and that, but no definite result. All that's a result of the sin of man. But God does have in mind a glorious, wonderful goal. In one of these days, God's high and holy purpose is to be accomplished, friends. And when it is, then you're going to see this earth on which you and I live today, you're going to see it redeemed and renewed. My, what a glorious day's in store for this earth. And man's sin is what's responsible for what's taken place. And you know, that's one of the reasons I think that you and I ought to have great sympathy for the animal world. Now, I personally have never been a great lover of pets. I never was permitted as a boy to have a dog. I wanted one then, but never was permitted to have one. And then later on, when I got older, why, I just guess I got to the place where I didn't want one. And today, I do not have a pet. But I have great sympathy today for the animal world. I feel sorry sometimes when I see some of these little dogs, the way they're treated and taken care of, and these cats today. Some of them get pretty rough treatment, let me tell you. And the animal world today, it gets pretty rough treatment. I hate to see a man beat a horse, you know. I don't care for that. Now, I'm sure I'll be misunderstood now, but frankly, a great many people today have gone in for this matter of horse racing. Now, I'm not even talking now about the gambling side of it. That's a moral side, and that's bad enough. But did you ever stop to think about this other side, about have you ever talked to the horses about the matter? How do they feel about it? Believe me, they are given pretty rough treatment. Oh, they're very valuable, of course. But I tell you, when one of them gets a little behind in the race, he's just not going to stay there very long. That is, if it's at all possible. And, of course, we've heard of the fact that they've been given shots of different things to help them along, you know. That's forbidden, but every now and then they are caught at that sort of thing. So that the animal world has to suffer today and does suffer. I hate to see it because the animal is innocent. It wasn't his sin, it's our sin. And because of that, you know, it ought to make us feel very kindly to an animal. Anytime you see an animal, I like to hunt. I think God intended for us. He's given these things for us to hunt and to eat. But I never like to wound anything. I do not like to wound game and not get it. I know that I'll spend more time trying to find a wounded bird than I will trying to get up others because of the fact that the suffering that the animal world endures today didn't come upon it because of its sin. And that dog that you don't like that barks at you, may I say to you that the dog didn't get that nature. That's not dog nature. That's your sin and my sin that's caused him to be that way. And that's true of the animal world today, the wild animal life. You see, nature's been subjected to all of this. A curse rests upon nature today, and it's there because of man's sin. And friends, that's the clear teaching of the Word of God. Now, let me read verse 21. Because the creature itself also shall be delivered from the bondage of corruption into the glorious liberty of the children of God. Now let me change that a little. Because the creation itself also shall be liberated from the slavery of the corruption into the liberty or the freedom of the glory of the children of God. Now the destiny of creation is linked with the hope of man. Just as creation went down in the crash when man sinned, creation is to be delivered when man is delivered. Now, let me give you a little different idea, maybe about something than you've thought of before. Sometimes the question comes into us, will there be any dogs in heaven? And I say no. And I always add that I'm glad they're not. I'm not particularly caring whether there are dogs going to be in heaven. There'll be no dogs in heaven. But may I say, dogs belong on this earth, and there are apparently going to be dogs here during the millennium. And I take it throughout eternity, animals are to be here. Now, if you would turn back into the Old Testament, you would find that we're told that the lion and the lamb are to lie down together. Their entire natures are to be changed. And that apparently they're going into the millennial kingdom. And if they go into the millennial kingdom, I'm almost sure the dogs are going to make it. Others will be. Now, heaven is a different place altogether. That is where the believers are going today. But this earth will be a place where there will be animals. And I do not mean to be facetious when I suggest this to you. If there's some of the saints who really want to keep a dog in throughout eternity, it may be that the Lord will let you keep one down here on this earth, and you can come down here every day and feed him if you want to. Now, if you want to do that, that'll be all right with me if the Lord lets you do it. I'm glad that I won't have to do that, though, because I don't want to do that sort of thing. But I'm sure there will be some folk that would want to do that. But I suggest that to you because this does happen to be a scriptural thing that we're looking at. This earth, you see, went under the crash, the fall of man. It went down in the awful crash that came. And now creation's going to come up out of that when man is redeemed. And that means that the animal world, plant life, everything is to be redeemed also. They are part of the new earth that there is to be. And that will introduce, if you please, the millennial kingdom here on this earth when those conditions prevail upon the earth. Now, what a glorious day is ahead, you see, for the earth. And what glorious prospects are in view for this earth. My, I tell you, this is really something to anticipate, and it is something to look forward to, is it not? Now, I trust that this may be maybe a new approach to an old problem for a great many people. And those that have been maybe a little put out with me when I've said there are not going to be dogs or cats in heaven, then maybe this will be the answer to your question. And I trust it might satisfy you. They will be here upon this earth because creation, because the creature, the creation itself, also shall be liberated from the slavery of the corruption into the liberty of the glory of the children of God. Now, the destiny of creation is linked, you see, with the hope of man. Man's dying body, even, is likewise linked to the corruption, you see, of creation. All about us is death in both the animal and plant world, and you and I are subject to it. Decay and death is at work on the great forest, bringing ugliness and barrenness. The great forest fires leave vast areas a scene of destruction, and the stench from the putrid bodies of dead animals fills the atmosphere. The cry of the wounded is heard. This reveals the extent and the depth of man's sin. When you hear that cry out yonder in the forest at night, some animal been wounded by another and throttled and killed, may I say that that's the result of the sin of man. But there's a glorious prospect in view, the liberty of the glory, and that speaks of the future, when creation will have liberty to express life and perfection and symmetry and beauty. And this is all inherent in nature, but it's thwarted by the slavery of man's sin. Nature will enter into the liberty of the glory of the children of God. The glory of heaven, but the glory of right here on this earth, the millennial earth. Oh, there are many pictures of this back in the Old Testament. I wonder if I have time to turn with you to, well, let's turn to just one. We can turn today to Isaiah, the 35th chapter. And there are many of these pictures, friends, back in the Old Testament. And you'll find a link there with the redemption of man's body, nature itself. Listen to this. The wilderness and the solitary place shall be glad for them, and the desert shall rejoice and blossom as the rose. Isn't that a beautiful picture? And it says, then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, the ears of the deaf shall be unstopped, then shall the lame man leap as an hart, the tongue of the dumb sing, for in the wilderness shall waters break out and streams in the desert. My, what a picture. It says that the ravenous beasts will not be there. The ransomed of the Lord shall return to Zion. You see, friends, that's all a picture on this earth of a redeemed earth, and that is what Paul is speaking about. Now, all of that is identified, you see, with our bodies. Our bodies today that are bodies of corruption, bodies of death, as we've seen. And these bodies that we have now must go down into the grave if the Lord tarries. And if he comes, these bodies are to be translated, and a tremendous transformation will have to take place in them to give us glorified bodies, be the same as death, because it means getting rid of the old nature and these old bodies that we've got, friends. These bodies that are subject to sickness and subject to pain and are filled today with disease and heartache and heartbreak and misery and arthritis and dim vision and all of these things. And just think of the mental illnesses there are today. All of that, friends, to be removed, and we'll receive redeemed bodies, and nature's to be redeemed. Can you think of a more glorious prospect than that? That is the prospect that God is holding out. And he's holding it out to this earth. May make it very real to you. Now, we have seen and emphasized that the destiny of creation is linked with the hope of man. In other words, in the redemption of Christ, when someone says to me, well, you know, healing is in the atonement. Well, gracious alive, so's a new body, but I don't have it yet. And not only that, but a new heaven and a new earth is in the atonement of Christ. But we don't have that yet either. And even if you got healed, my brother, if the Lord tarries, and he may, you're going to die. I don't care how good you got healed, you're going to die. So that, after all, that's not a permanent thing. I personally am anxious about this new body that's coming along one of these days. And God has one for you, has one for me. That is, all of those that are redeemed. And that will complete our redemption, by the way. But we are not yet completely redeemed. When God saved me, He didn't give me a new body. He gave me a new heart, I think. He gave me a new spirit, a new nature, but not yet a new body. And that's yet to come along. Now, when I get that, and you get yours, then nature, you see, has a great hope at stake, and what a glorious thing is in the future. And they'll be delivered into the liberty of the glory. And that speaks of the future. Now, verse 22. For we know that the whole creation groaneth and travaileth in pain together until now. Now, the translation that we want to give you here reads like this. For we know that the whole creation is groaning and is suffering birth pangs together until now. Now, the word for here introduces the proof of the hope of creation. We know. How do we know? Well, the child of God knows from the book of nature. The Christian looks about him today and he sees in nature the evidence of this groaning and suffering. Now, the natural man, he makes out, by the way, a very unnatural case for nature. He sees in nature something quite wonderful. That is, even today. Browning, for instance, in Pippa's Passes. You remember how he concluded that? God's in his heaven, and all's well with the world. Is it? No, it's not. Browning was wrong. That's poetry, of course. Someone has said that poetic license is prosaic lying. And that's not true. All's well with the world. That can't be said today. All's not well with the world. And every child of God today is like nature, groaning and travailing, waiting for that day. There's not a Christian listening to me today. You're satisfied with the way things are today. That's one reason that Christians have changed this world as much as they have. It's the reason that they produced a civilization that's never been exceeded in the history of the world. A Western civilization today has a veneer on it that can be called Christian civilization. Although it's not Christian, it's been tremendously affected by it. For instance, there was this awful thing known as slavery. It had come out of the ancient world. It had come even into the Roman world, and the church had more or less accepted it. And yet every Christian, even in that day, was a protest against it. And it couldn't stand in the presence of Christianity. And there came a day when in the great Methodist revivals, a man by the name of William Wilberforce, was saved. A man that was a great statesman in England. And this man, dissatisfied with it, led a movement. And that movement was a great reform movement. And it affected every bit of the social life of England. So much so that England had a revival and France had a revolution. Because it was coming. Things were so rotten. But the thing is that Christians moved in. And one of the things that Wilberforce instigated was that this slave trade should stop. It should cease. And it did, my friend. That's been the effect of Christianity upon the civilization of the world, although I don't think that you could call it Christian civilization today that we have, but it's been tremendously affected. Why? Because Christians are not satisfied with the status quo today, even. Every Christian that I'm speaking to you to today, you do not believe today that all's well with the world. You're not willing to sit back and say all's well when you know good and well that it's not well, and that there's a glorious, wonderful day coming. And actually what's happening right now, the whole creation is groaning and is suffering birth pangs, just like a woman ready to bring forth a child in travail. That's the picture of the world today. That's a picture of nature today. And all's not well with the world. The Christian looks upon nature, marred by sin, but with a glorious anticipation of the future. Listen to Joel. Back in the prophecy of Joel in the first chapter, the 18th verse. How do the beasts groan? The herds of cattle are perplexed because they have no pasture. Yea, the flocks of sheep are made desolate. What a picture, my friend, today of nature. And that is God's picture, if you please. The beasts actually groan, we're told. That is their picture. And someone has called our attention to the fact that nature today even sings in a minor key. The wind blowing through the pine trees on a mountainside, or the breaking of the surf on some lonely shore, both emit the same sob, and it's in a minor key. You know, I love to get up in the mountains and at night, lie down and hear the wind blowing through the pine tree. Makes you feel rather lonesome, doesn't it? Makes you feel sort of funny, because it's no hallelujah chorus to rouse you up. It's in the mood to put you to sleep. That's nature, if you please. And many of us like to go down to the seashore. Again, may I say, that's not rock and roll music that you'll be listening to. That's not jazz. That's not the kind of music that will wake you up. Actually, it's very doleful music. You hear those waves breaking at night. Anywhere that you turn to nature today, why, it's a doleful sound. It's a pierced cry. Why, the pierced cry of some frightened animal, a bird, in the night air, chills the blood, does it not? Nature bears audible testimony to the accuracy of Scripture today. Oh, my friend, what a commentary nature itself is today upon the Word of God. It was Schelling, the great German, who wrote, "Nature with its melancholy chorus resembles a bride who, at the very moment when she was fully attired for marriage, saw the bridegroom die. She still stands with her fresh crown and in her bridal dress, but her eyes are full of tears." What a picture that is of nature today. Nature arrayed in the springtime with the lovely flowers and the singing of the birds. How beautiful at that time. But like Schelling says, it's like the bride. The marriage, it just wasn't consummated. The bridegroom died. And there stands nature in tears. And before long, that beautiful blanket of flowers are withered and dried and dead. And before long, the singing of the birds is not heard. Before long, there's nothing in the world but the sob and sigh of the wind. What a picture, friends. Nature is a real commentary today. And what is it doing? Well, nature's in birth pangs, friends. And birth pangs are the signal that something wonderful is going to take place. A man-child is born. You remember the prophet said that a woman, after a man-child is born, she forgets about her travail. Well, nature today's in travail. But one of these days, he's coming forward. A great change, a great transformation will take place in nature. You see, men can't produce the millennium down here. They've tried it, and they're still trying it. Now it's the World Council of Churches. They're going to bring it in, you know, the millennium, so they think. They want to build a utopia down here. I thank God that we don't have to wait upon that crowd to build a utopia, nor do we need to look to them for a millennium, because they'll never produce it. They can't produce it. They said during the great drought in the Dust Bowl, you remember when President Roosevelt was in office, he made a trip out through the Dust Bowl, arrived at one little town, the train stopped, and he stood on the back platform to look at the scene that was before him and to give a message of encouragement to the people. But some wag had made a sign, and he was held aloft, and the sign read, "You gave us beer, now give us rain." But even the great Mr. Roosevelt couldn't give us rain, you see. And men can't do that. Only God can do that. And not until the Lord Jesus Christ comes, friends, are we going to have a millennium down here upon this earth. But it's coming, and nature today is just in birth pangs, waiting for that glorious day. Now we come in verse 23 to another new section. It's the fifth section of chapter 8. And now we have the new body. You see, everything in this chapter, friends, has been new that we've had. We've just had all the way through everything is new this and new that. And this is God's new way. We've had the new law, the new struggle, the new man. And now we've come down to where we have something else that's new. And this, of course, is the new body. We saw the new creation, and we left off last time with verse 22, where it reads, "For we know that the whole creation is groaning and suffering birth pangs together until now." And now we have the new body. Now Paul is coming, actually, to a high point here, beginning with verse 23, down through verse 27. The new body, the groaning body that we have today versus the redeemed body. The body of humiliation versus the glorified body. Now, you and I are living in a universe today that is blighted and plagued by the curse of sin. It's anywhere you turn today, friends. You can't go anywhere and not see the effects of sin upon this earth. Have you ever driven from California back across the country? Or have you driven from the other section of the country out? I'm sure most of us have gone one way or the other. And have you ever noticed mile after mile of desert? Evidences of the fact of the curse of sin upon this earth. It's sort of like the fella that put up his house for sale. He went to one of these high-pressure real estate men and asked him to sell it for him, and the real estate man wrote an ad up in the paper about this house. And the man came in, and he said, "Look here," says, "you got a house advertised here, and I sure would like to buy it." And the man says, "Well, that's your house." He says, "You mean that's my house that you've got written up in this advertisement?" Man says, "Yes." Well, he says, "Well, I think I'll keep it. I didn't know that it was that good a place." Well, that's the thing that many of us like to do. We like to read what the Chamber of Commerce has to say in order to convince ourselves that the curse of sin is not around us. But it is around us. Friends, anywhere you turn today, you find evidences of the curse of sin. And it's in creation. Now, it's going through birth pangs. It began in the Garden of Eden, and it's going to continue until the great travail of the great tribulation period. And out of that time, there will come a deliverance. And after that, a new day will be born. That is the millennium. Now, that's for this earth that we're talking about.